All right. I think we might as well get started. There's more of the PowerPoint things on a chair back there. If I have some here, too, if anybody wants to take any afterwards or whatever. So we're looking at Numbers chapters 7 through 9 this morning. And I don't know if these are the kinds of chapters that you just kind of read in your devotional time and get really excited and stuff. I think we should. But I think it's helpful to be able to discuss chapters like this in community and see the relevancy for these things. But this is the outline chart that we've been referencing as we've been studying the book of Numbers. And at least the way that my simplistic way of wanting to remember the book is chapters 1 through 10, they're at Mount Sinai. 11 through 21, they start sojourning towards the Promised Land. And that's when they wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And then finally in 22 to 36, they're setting up to enter the Promised Land. One of the things that I haven't mentioned about Numbers so far is that throughout the book, there's going to be stories interspersed by laws. And whenever you've got like the stories of disobedience, it's followed by laws that they need to keep. And then the next story is them basically breaking some more of God's laws. So they're not doing what God wants them to be doing. That's not true for the first 10 chapters, though. For the first 10 chapters, like, every time, the Israelites are obeying. And so when you get to chapters 10 and 11, and they start complaining, and then you got Miriam and Moses and everything that happens in Numbers chapter 12, it kind of jars you a little bit. But we remember in the book of Numbers their disobedience, but really for the first, like, third of the book, they are doing everything God says. Which, for me anyways, has been one of those things that has been more overlooked by my understanding of the book of Numbers. So, but the laws that are given throughout the book, like even when you get to chapters like 15 or so, there's going to be laws that can only be fulfilled once they get into the Promised Land. And I said in the first class that you see God's wrath, you see His severity in this book, but you also see His grace and His mercy towards the people. Because embedded into those laws is the promise that you guys are going to be in the Promised Land one day. And so the laws have a kind of hope to them. And we'll see those, especially when we get to that middle section in chapters 11 through 21. Alright, so this is also a picture of the camp. I gave this picture out last week, it's not in the thing today. But this is, again, a helpful reminder to imagine what would it have been like to see these people camping. You got this little idea of this father looking down with his son at this camp. And you remember, what side of the camp would you want to be on? Yeah, the east side. There's a few reasons for that. What are some of the reasons you'd want to be on the east side? Yeah, that's where the entrance to the tabernacle is. That's one reason. What about the folks that were on the east side? Who were they? You got Judah, like the prominent tribe. What's the buffer zone between the tribe of Judah and the tabernacle? It was the priests. The Levites were on all the other sides. And so that's why, remember, there's 22,000 Levites. So you got some of them here, you've got some of them there, and you've got some of them there. There's not a lot of priests, and so but you got them there. And so this is like the holiest side, if you will. And so that would be really cool to be on that side, and it would be a privilege and stuff like that. All right, so and then there's the depiction of the cloud there, and we'll say some things about that when we get into chapter 9. Anything you guys want to say just by way of reminder or introduction? Yeah. Right. Good. Yeah, the idea that the sun rises on the east side too, and that they would have the first, you know, the first sunlight of the day and stuff. But it correlates to creation and stuff. Good. Anything else? Okay. I'm just gonna read something in Acts 2:42, and maybe this isn't super related to what we're talking about. I just think it's cool, and I think we can talk about stuff that. Whatever, I don't know. So, in Acts chapter 2, after there's 3,000 people that repent and are baptized, and we've talked about the Old Testament kind of opposite of the 3,000 people being baptized. Remember in Exodus 32, when the people worship the golden calf, it's the Levitical tribe that takes their sword, and how many people do they kill at Mount Sinai? 3,000. And then by way of contrast, when the law of the Spirit is given out in Acts 2, there's 3,000 people that are converted. There's other connections, I think, going on in Acts 2 with these things that we see happening at Mount Sinai. And if you look at Acts 2:42, I'll just go ahead and read this. It says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, the breaking of bread, and the prayers. I would suggest that in verse 42, these things that they're devoting themselves to have a correlation to the things in the tabernacle that we've been looking at in the book of Numbers. So, for example, the apostles' teaching. What is the candlestick in the temple or the tabernacle pictured as? It's the thing that gives light. It enlightens them in the work that they're doing. Here's people that are devoting themselves to the new candlestick, the new thing that gives enlightenment, and that's the apostles' teaching. You also have them being devoted to the fellowship. What is the purpose of the tabernacle? It's for God to dwell there. And we're going to see in Numbers chapter 7 this morning that Moses is communing with God in the tabernacle. And so they're devoted to the fellowship. They're devoted to the breaking of bread. One of the things that was in the tabernacle was the table of showbread. And so there's some connections there, I think. And then also you've got the prayers. The altar of incense is connected to the idea of constantly praying before God. I don't know if you've seen that before in Acts 2:42, but all the things that they're doing, I think, is the true fulfillment of the tabernacle. And maybe this helps us think about maybe some of the relevancy for Christians today in studying some of these things. These are all looking forward to what Jesus was going to be and do, and what we were going to be and do and partake of, and all of that. And so maybe that helps us just a little bit orient ourselves to what we're looking at. One other thing I'll say by way of introduction is that Numbers chapter 7 through 9 chronologically take place before Numbers 1 through 6. We started the book with the census and then getting ready to camp and stuff like this. But the things that we're seeing here actually took place beforehand, and you see that with the timing references in 7:1 and 9:1. Just, I don't know, whatever that's worth, it's just maybe good to know that. Anything you guys want to say about any of that stuff? Alright, so the outline of what we're looking at today, chapter 7, is we're going to see these offerings that are given at the tabernacle for the Levites. And then in chapter 8, we're going to see the lamps and the Levites. And then in chapter 9, we're going to see God's guidance both with the Passover, and we're going to see it with how he guided them with the pillar of fire in the cloud in the wilderness. So let's go ahead and get started then in chapter 7 with the offerings. Let me go ahead and read some stuff about the carts that the Levites were given. So in chapter 7, this is the second longest chapter in the Bible. Anybody know what the first longest chapter in the Bible is? Yeah, Psalm 119. Psalm 119 is like bigger than Galatians. It's bigger than Philippians. It's like bigger than a lot of, I think, 15 of the books of the Bible or something. But Numbers 7 is a pretty long chapter as well. I want to just read the first 7 verses here, or the first 9 verses, and say some things about these carts that the Levites are given. On the day when Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle and had anointed and consecrated it with all its furnishings and had anointed and consecrated the altar with its utensils, the chiefs of Israel, heads of their fathers' houses, were the chiefs of the tribes who were over those things who were listed, approached, and brought their offerings before the Lord, 6 wagons and 12 oxen, a wagon for every 2 of the chiefs, and for each one of an ox. They brought them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord said to Moses, accept these from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, and give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service. So Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 wagons and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon, according to their service. And 4 wagons and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. But to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because they were charged with the service of the holy things that had to be carried on the shoulder. There's a couple things that I think are interesting about these carts that are provided to the Levites. Are these carts distributed evenly amongst these families? No. So Gershon got 2 wagons and 4 oxen. You guys remember how we could remember what Gershon carried? The girly things. So they had they carried the fabrics and all that sort of thing. And so fabrics don't weigh a ton, so they don't need to have the most amount of wagons to carry the stuff. What about Merari? How do we remember what they carried? Manly things. So G is girly,
M is manly, so they need, they're carrying the frames and the stuff that weighs a lot for the tabernacle. So they're given more wagons and they're given more oxen. But that expends all of these oxen and wagons because Kohath ends up getting how many? None. And how do we remember what Kohath carries? There's an H in the middle of Kohath. They carry the holy things. All right, so do you guys remember any stories in the Bible where maybe some of the holy things weren't being transported the right way? Uzzah, yeah. And how many years, maybe 800 years or something, after these laws are given, then you've got Uzzah reaching out to touch the ark. God's laws are never antiquated. You're always supposed to follow them no matter how old they are and stuff like that. But one, I think one application to make from this, did you notice that it was worded a couple times? He gave them according to their service. He gave them according to their service. The New Testament may be parallel to this, is that God gives his gifts and he gives his abilities and he gives his resources to people according to the need of the service that God has given them to do. Do you think it would have made sense for Gershon to look at Merari and gotten jealous that they didn't get as many wagons and oxen? Do you think it would have made sense for Kohath to go, come on, this isn't fair? No. Do you think this ever happens in a local church, though? Where people can look at the abilities of other people, the financial resources of other people, whatever the thing might be that's kind of bothering you, and start to wonder, how come it was distributed this way? God does it the way that he wants to for his purposes to work in the way that he wants it to. So, and I think this is one of those Old Testament kind of examples of that that I hadn't given much attention to before. Do you guys have any thoughts about the carts? Anything else you want to add to that? Okay, then we get to the tribal offerings, which is verses 10 through 88. I'm going to have a picture on the next slide that details what each tribe gave. But from verses like 10 through, is it 83? Yeah, 10 through 83, you've got 12 paragraphs. And each tribe is giving the exact same thing. And I like that the tribe, what tribe was the biggest one? Judah. Wouldn't it make sense that they should have given a little bit more? And I think it was Manasseh was the smallest tribe. I like that God is treating each tribe equally. Everybody gives the same amount. God sees the sacrifice of every tribe. Every tribe is given the same amount of inspired ink about the sacrifices that they're giving here. And so maybe this kind of balances a little bit of what we just looked at. You've got the unequal distribution of the carts and the oxen. And then the very next thing that you see in this chapter is God seeing exactly what each people gave. So you might be tempted to look at what other people have and all, you know, whatever. But when you look at what you're giving to God, God sees exactly what you're giving him, and he acknowledges that. And so you see them doing that. The only difference with each paragraph from verses 10 through 83 is there's a difference in day, because it's days 1 through 12, each tribe is making these sacrifices for the things in the tabernacle. And then the tribal leaders are obviously going to be different. And then verses 84 to 88 is the summary of that. Skip down to verse 89, though. And I'll say more about what they gave on the next PowerPoint slide. But look at the last verse of this chapter. And when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with the Lord, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two cherubim, and it spoke to him. So, the purpose of the tabernacle, again, was for God to dwell with his people. What is it that the New Testament says about Jesus in John 1? That he tabernacled with us, he spoke with us in human flesh. But I think we shouldn't miss that after all the sacrifices are given, that's when Moses has communion with God. We need to have a sacrifice given so that we can have communion with God as well. All right, so that's chapter 7. Anything you guys want to say just about this stuff before we look at the chart that shows what each tribe gave?
It's really a total sacrifice of self that he's individual, isn't it? If you look at it that way, it makes
a difference
in our attitude.
Right. Good. Good. Anything else? All right. So here's this chart here. We're not exactly sure how much a shekel was, but each tribe gave this same exact thing, where they would have this big bowl, a little bowl, each had flour in it, and then you'd also have this golden dish with incense in it. You got the burnt offering with the bull, the ram, the lamb, and then the sin offering for the male goat. The sacrifice of peace, or the sacrifice of well-being, has got a lot of animals in each one of them. So every single day for 12 days, each tribe is providing this same stuff to the tabernacle. Now, why did they do this? Because God commanded it? Good. What other reasons can you think of? Yeah, these were things that were going to provide for the priests a lot of the things that they needed. It was kind of like a Kickstarter for the things that they would need in their service to the Lord. And so they're getting all of this from the tribes. The way that the Levites and the priests were going to be supported was going to be by the sacrifices of the people, so that they could focus on those kinds of things that they were going to be doing for the Lord. So that's what each tribe gave, and each one equally gave the same thing. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Alright, look at chapter 8, and we'll look at verses 1 through 4 with them lighting the lamp then. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, and seven lamps shall be light in front of the lampstand. And Aaron did so. He set up its lamps in front of the lampstand, so as the Lord commanded Moses. And this was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold. From its base to its flowers, it was hammered work according to the pattern that the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand." Okay, why did God have them have a lampstand? And this is a cutout of the tabernacle here, so that's where it would be on the left side when you walk in. What was the purpose of having this lamp, or in Hebrew it's menorah? Yeah, the purpose of it was to give light in the place where the Levites, the priests, and everything were going to be doing all the work that they were going to be doing. And there's some connections there with Jesus. Jesus said he was the light of the world. Jesus tells us that we're the light of the world, and we're supposed to be shining in dark places so that people can know how to serve God faithfully and stuff like that. What was it made out of? Yeah, solid gold. Does anybody... So, like, if you were to think about the other things that are in the tabernacle, the other things are made of wood and then overlaid with gold. This was the only thing that was strictly made of gold. And so that, I'm not sure what all the reasons are for that, but that's interesting. It also resembles a tree. Because what tree kind of imagery do you see in this lamp? Yeah, like, how do you see that, like, in this text? What is it that is associated with it that makes you think of a tree? Like in verse 4.
Flowers.
Yeah, flowers. So, in the tabernacle, you've got all kinds of things that remind you of a garden or a tree of life. Why would that be the case?
That was the beginning of the garden.
Right.
Where God walked with them.
Yes, God was with his people. I think we've had some conversations about this before. What parallels can you think of between the Garden of Eden and the tabernacle? Where God dwells, what else? He spoke with the people there. We just saw that with Moses. Which direction was Adam and Eve evicted from the garden? East. What's the entryway to the tabernacle? To the east? All right. Can you guys think of any other ones?
The cherubim on the north side.
Yes, the cherubim. Where God was just speaking to Moses. You got the cherubim. What does that remind you of with the Garden of Eden? The angels with the flaming swords that weren't allowing people to come in. In the tabernacle, this curtain here that separated the holy place from the most holy place, what was woven into that curtain? Cherubim. And then you go in and then there's more cherubim. And so that was kind of like God's keep out sign for the nation, that they weren't supposed to come into this place. That's what it was for the Garden of Eden. But the difference is that now this place has more access than the Garden of Eden did. So as the story of the Bible goes, God created man to be in fellowship with God. And because of our sin, we had to be evicted. Man had to be evicted from God's presence. And so what is God going to do to try to reconnect us back to Him? Well, you got the picture of this in the tabernacle, where you don't have full access, but there's more access than what you have at the Garden of Eden. And all of this was eventually looking forward to Jesus, and when He died on the cross, what happened with that veil? It tore in two. All right, so the reason that I'm importing all of this, or bringing all of this up, is when you just see something as simple as this lamp that has flowers on it, it reminds you of the Garden of Eden. And so does, like, everything else in the tabernacle. One other thing to say about parallels is that when Adam was told to work and keep the garden, that Hebrew word is the same word where the Levites and the priests are told to guard the tabernacle, like kind of be the buffer zone of it and stuff. Adam was supposed to guard the Garden of Eden from things like snakes, and he didn't do a very good job of that. And so all of that, you see, like, the nation of Israel becomes a microcosm of what God wanted to do with the whole world. Does that make sense? I probably went through all that way too fast. I did preach a sermon on it, like, 8 months ago, so everybody should probably remember all that, right? Okay, so it resembles a tree, reminds you of the Garden of Eden, and then also, again, in verses 3 and 4, they're lighting the candle exactly like they're supposed to. They're doing everything that God has asked them to do according to the pattern that God had shown Moses. Now, when you see that word pattern in verses 3 and 4, what does the word pattern mean? And what's the idea behind that?
It's a design. And for anybody that sews, you go by a pattern. Or if you build a house, you have a blueprint, which is a pattern.
Right.
And it represents something else.
Yeah, and it represents something else. It's like, did any of you guys ever take, like, an art class in college or high school or whatever, and the teacher would have maybe they would put a vase on their table, and then you have to draw it out and copy it. And so it becomes like the pattern that you're following. So for Moses to be shown a pattern means that he was shown something that was, like, real, and then he has to try to replicate it. It's like, have you guys ever been to the Noah's Ark thing in Kentucky? That's very much worth the time to go there. Even if you can't go inside of it, just seeing the outside size of it is amazing. But when I was there a few years ago, I got, like, a little replica of Noah's Ark. And it's supposed to be, like, this, you know, to scale and all that sort of thing. It's like a little, it's a little microcosm, or it's a little replica of the real thing. The tabernacle was a little replica of something that Moses saw in heaven. And that's eventually where we're going to be and everything like that. So the studying of the tabernacle is just kind of like heaven shrunk down here so that we can get a picture of where we're going. Does that make sense? Okay. Anything else that you guys want to say just about the lamp that was lit so that they could do the work?
This was the fact that it had seven lights have significance. It seems like...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Revelation brings this imagery up about to the seven spirits, grace and peace, and all that stuff.
Back to creation, the 7 days.
Right, the 7 days of creation, and that there's another Garden of Eden kind of connection. Then maybe, yeah, that's a good point. And every day there was evening and morning, except for the last day. But there was light, right? And in the creation that God made.
Some call it the perfect number.
The perfect, yeah. Right, and the first time that we read the number 7 in the Bible is on the seventh day of rest, where there is no evening and morning, but the first thing that God does is He says, let there be light. So, yeah, that's good. Alright, anything else you guys want to say about that? Alright, yeah.
I was going to ask you a question. What connection would you say between the candlestick and the churches in Revelation? Let me hear what you're thinking.
So my understanding of in Revelation chapter 1, where Jesus is amongst the seven lampstands, which are the seven churches, that the expectation of a local church is that they shine and that they're equipping each other to go out and be lights in the world, that if people were to come in here, they would see that the Lord is among us and stuff like that. And in the seven churches, He's saying, I can take out your candlestick. I can take the light away. Has there been churches in the history of the world that have had to close their doors? Not always, but sometimes, because they were a bunch of knuckleheads, and they didn't understand their purpose. God, God has the ability to do that. But I think the idea of it is that our mission is to be shining as lights. And Jesus is walking in our midst like he was with those seven candlesticks. And that helps us know that he sees everything that we're doing. But he's also there to encourage us.
Okay, so that, and that definitely has a relevance to the candlestick that was in the tabernacle.
Yes. Yeah, it eventually represents how we're going to be the light of the world. Yeah, that's what I see. Do you see something else in that?
No, I was just wondering about your thoughts.
I'll say one other thing. I kind of want to do a segment. I don't know. I think there'd be enough stuff to say about it. But like doing a segment on the clothing of the priests and like everything about the tabernacle that we can understand and dissect without a lot of guesswork and stuff, like the things that are clear in the Bible. Like everything in the tabernacle is looking forward to Jesus. The colors of the curtains, what colors were they? You got like purple, that's like color of royalty and all this stuff. Like all of this is a microcosm of heaven. It's also a microcosm of our mission and our purpose and who Jesus is and all of those different kinds of things. You can take something down.
There was a brother in Oregon when we were there that made a reference to the curtain being torn, was it from the top to the bottom?
Right.
And I can't remember what his reference about that was. I believe he said normally it would rip from the bottom to the top.
Hopefully normally it wouldn't rip. But the fact that it rips from the top to the bottom means that like nobody crawled up there to do it because it was like 12 inches thick or something. It was really thick. And I think the point of that is that it had to have been a divine act of judgment to rip that open, or a divine act of grace, symbolically saying that God's presence is now going out. And so it's not confined to this place where you had limited access. So yeah, good. And ironically, after that happens, when Jesus is being crucified, the first person to confess that Jesus is the Son of God is a Roman. So God's presence is now accessible to everybody. So... alright, so we talked a lot more than just about the lamps, but this is talking about the tabernacle, so I guess we can talk about that stuff too. Okay, so here we've got the consecration of the Levites who are going to serve in the tabernacle kind of quarters and stuff. And I have up here the differences in the consecration with the priests and the Levites. And for me, this is helpful because I haven't always had it super clear in my mind. What are the differences between the priests and the Levites? Well, notice some things about how they were consecrated. So the priests in Leviticus 8, and you can remember this, the priests in Leviticus 8, the Levites were consecrated in Numbers 8. So the priests, they had to wash themselves in water, they put on new clothes, and then blood was applied to them, and then they were made holy. There's a lot of parallels, by the way, for the Christian. Right? Because we have to be washed in water, and then we put on Christ, and the blood of Christ gets applied to us, and we're made holy and set apart for his purposes and stuff like that. So, but then by way of contrast, for the Levites, they're sprinkled with water, and then they have to shave, and then they wash their clothes, which, by the way, these first three things are very similar to what the lepers have to do in Leviticus 13 and 14. So they have to do those things, and then they're made clean. They're not declared holy. And so their consecration doesn't involve as much as what it is for the Levites. But how many Levites had to be consecrated? Do you guys remember the number back in chapter 3? Remember there was a discrepancy with there was so many firstborn and then there were so many Levites. The difference was 273. There's 22,000 priests that they have to consecrate here. And so imagine that the camp of Israel gets all of these guys together, and what the nation of Israel does with these guys resembles in some ways what they would do with sacrificial animals. So look at chapter 8, verse 10. 8, verse 10. When you bring the Levites before the Lord, the people of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. That's very similar to what they would have to do with the sacrificial animals. They would lay their hands on them, and there's different debates on why they would do that. The text doesn't explicitly tell us why they would lay hands on the animals. But they're laying hands on the Levites here. And then what kind of offering are they said to be in this text? But, yeah, a wave offering. What's a wave offering?
Like, we're familiar with the burnt offering. We're familiar with the...
You can get a thigh and wave it.
Yeah. So you kind of wave it. That's, yeah, so like a burnt offering, what do you do with it? You burn it. A grain offering, what kind of offering is it? It's a grain offering. A wave offering, so you wave it. Okay, why do you do that, though? It's like a a dedication to God, because let's say that I'm gonna dedicate this PowerPoint clicker, all right? So and then like it's not floating up in the air, so what do I do with it? I now use it for what I need to use it for. So it's a way of acknowledging, God, I realize this is yours, but you stewarded this to me for your purposes. Okay. So they become a wave offering, where the nation of Israel is recognizing that these people belong to God, but they're going to be in service to us in some ways. By the way, can you think of modern day applications of a wave offering? So like, okay, I got 3 kids. Are they my kids? Like, do good parents realize that the kids that they have really belong to God, and that they're trying to be stewards of God's gifts and blessings and stuff like that? What about, like, even the technology we have? Can people do all kinds of bad things with their anonymity online and look up things that they shouldn't be looking up and hurt people that they shouldn't be hurting and all these kinds of things? The idea of a wave offering is the acknowledgement that this belongs to the Lord and I'm going to dedicate it to Him, but He's given me the stewardship of these things. It's really how we should view our whole lives. Were you saying to me?
Yeah, one of the Psalms, I believe, it says, He owns the cattle on 1,000 acres.
Yes.
Hills, which is a reminder that God actually owns everything.
Yes.
We don't, we're just stewards of everything that we think we call our possessions.
Right.
They actually belong to God.
Yes, very good. And so when you see what they're doing with these Levites, it's like they become a living sacrifice. Like Romans 12. Like Christians are supposed to be a living sacrifice in light of the mercies of God. All of those kinds of ideas. And so yes, we should acknowledge that everything that we have, the air that we have to breathe, all of that is from God. And the person that lives sober-mindedly acknowledges that I need to be a steward for God's purposes of everything that I have. So they do that with them. And just a few other things to say about verses 14 through 26 is that the Levites were chosen over the firstborn. Do you remember in the Passover, all the Egyptian people died, the firstborn in Egypt died, which also meant that the firstborn in Israel should have died, but they didn't because of the blood on the doorposts. And so God says in Exodus 13 that the firstborn belonged to me, but rather than perhaps God using the firstborn to be the servants of the priests, God chooses who? The Levites, perhaps because of Exodus 32, when they were the ones that walked around the camp and killed the 3,000 that worshipped on the golden calf. So that could be some of the explanation for that. And you could say then that the Levites in the Old Testament were kind of like the deacons of the New Testament. So in a local church, what are the positions of leadership? Elders, deacons, and preachers. So, what is the Old Testament kind of similarities or parallels to those? So you got the deacons are kind of like the Levites. The elders would kind of be like who? Maybe the priests. Who is compared to who were the shepherds in the ancient world? Do you guys remember? Have you ever seen pictures of Pharaoh? They've got a flail in one arm, and then what's on the other one? A shepherd's crook. Why? Because in the ancient world, kings were pictured as shepherds because they were supposed to lead the people and all this kind of thing. And so when you see the qualifications for kings or the commands for kings in Deuteronomy 17 that they're supposed to read the law and they're not supposed to multiply wives to themselves, have you ever compared that to the qualifications for elders in 1 Timothy 3? Husband of one wife, they're not supposed to be greedy for unjust gain. It's very similar what's required of both of them. And so the Old Testament parallel, I think, to the elders are maybe the kings. And then you've got the prophets who are supposed to be rebuking the people and making them feel bad so that they stay humble, and that sounds like they're the preacher or something, I don't know.
Alright. So when they are told to do this, they promptly obey, just like we've been seeing them do in the first 10 chapters. They consecrate the Levites like they're supposed to. Let me point out something about verses 23 to 26. I think this is interesting. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This applies to the Levites. From 25 years old and upward, they shall come to do the duty of the service of the tent of meeting. And from age 50, they shall withdraw from the duty of the service and serve no more. They minister to their brothers in the tent of meeting by keeping guard, but they shall do no service. Thus shall you do to the Levites in assigning their duties." Okay. So, from 25 to 50. I thought that we saw earlier that how old did they have to be to start? I thought it was 30 in chapter 4, verse 3. So how come here it says it's 25? Anybody have any ideas on that?
Is it the Levites or the priests?
This is the Levites. Yeah, because if you go back to Numbers chapter 4, verse 3... take a census from the sons of Kohath and from among the sons of Levi by their clans and their father's houses from 30 years old to 50.
So what do we say about that? How come one chapter says it's 30 and the other chapter says it's 25?
It refers specifically to the division of
Kohath,
though. It could be, but... Then later on he says, "Do not cut off the tribes of the families of the Kohathites."
Look at verse 47 of chapter 4. All those who were listed of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron and the chiefs of Israel listed by their clans and their father's houses, from 30 years old up to 50 years old, everyone who could come to do the service of the ministry and the service of the bearing of burdens in the tent of meeting. So we've been wrong all along, right? The Bible's not reliable. And we need to stop what we're doing.
Yeah, 25, they're set apart, and then...
Yeah, I
then at 30, they start to work, they serve.
Yeah, could it be that there's like a five-year apprenticeship sort of thing, or something like that? What adds some more confusion to it is that in Chronicles, when David is reorganizing how everything goes, the age goes down to 20. And so I think there's maybe different stages of preparation, I think is sort of the idea to that. But I do think there's something to say about the fact that God puts limitations on ages. Are there limitations of being younger? What are the limitations of being younger? Yeah, you think you know more than you really do. You don't have the wisdom that it takes to handle God's holy things appropriately. What are the limitations of being older? Oh, we have more comments there, right? I want to know what's going to happen to me. Yeah, your physical strength isn't as good, and so, like, you're not able to carry all of these things and stuff like this as much anymore. Even after the age of 50, though, what could some people still do? In verse 26. Yeah, they could still keep guard. So, like, there's some guys that are, like, in their 50s that are, like, you don't want to mess with that dude. Like, you can still be a security guard, but you can't lift stuff because you might trip or something like that and break some of these holy things that you're supposed to carry. And so I just think this is interesting that God acknowledged there's limitations of being young and there's limitations of being old. And I guess the sweet spot is from 25 to 50 or something. I don't know. But no matter what stage in life that we're in, we have certain strengths and we have certain weaknesses. And the more we can just acknowledge what those things are, I think the better we can actually do the service that God has called us to do.
And there are things that we can do at every age that are in the service of the Lord.
Yes.
It changes, but it should go on.
Right.
As long as we believe.
There's no retirement. In the sense that our culture thinks about it. Yeah.
I don't know that there is a significance that God put an age limit to it. Because Moses lived, you know, a long time and was able to lead. God enabled different ones to live longer and be able to do their thing. He was able to give children to Abraham and Sarah, right, and so forth. So it's not so much that God is limiting, and not so much that we have to limit ourselves. Oh, we're 50 years old, we can't do this and that. But that he just specifically wanted this for this particular job.
Yeah, maybe. When I trained with Barry Percival, though, and I moved to Tennessee, he said, "I'm sorry, I didn't help you unpack all your stuff, but in the Old Testament, Levites didn't have kids." But then he said, "When I was in Arkansas, I was like 51 years old, and I helped somebody move, and I like really threw my back out. And like ever since then, I'm like, I'm done with this kind of stuff. There's younger people that can do it." Either way, though, there are limitations of being younger, and then there are limitations of being older. And just being able to acknowledge what those are, rather than wishing that it was the other way around or whatever, is just a lot of wasted time and energy. Just accept your situation in life now and do what you can do now. Yeah.
Well, doesn't that show wisdom when you're older if you say, you know, I really shouldn't do that?
Yeah.
Because I may throw my back.
Right. Yeah, I think it does.
I think it does.
Yeah. I mean, were you saying?
Oh, my grandmother lived to be almost 102. And her friend got up on a chair that was like old to change a light bulb, fell, and broke her hip and died. Well, my grandmother said, I'm not going to change the light bulb. I'm not going to get up on a chair.
Right.
To change. I mean, it was.
Well, and when I moved here, Sewell was carrying boxes all over the place. I'm like, dude, you need to stop doing that. Like,
Larry Jones pulled up, and Dad was up on a ladder cleaning the gutters. And Larry says, "Don't you ever do that?"
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times when you're older and you realize that you can't do it, you're almost ashamed. You feel ashamed to say, "I better not do that."
Yeah.
And so that just God says, if you can't do it, don't feel ashamed and don't show a lack of wisdom by trying to do it anyway. Just show that you can.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
I like to remember, His grace is sufficient, that regardless of what kind of limitation we may have, that we still have Christ, and there are ways that we can serve Him. I mean, with that attitude that Paul had, we know he had numerous times when he could have given up or done something else, regardless of his initial thing
right.
He was given him, about the beatings and all that.
Yeah, and I think in Corinthians when he says that our my body wastes away daily, like but the inner man is renewed.
But his zeal for the Lord and his work that he could do, he continued.
Right.
All the way.
Yeah, I do think when Paul talks about how the outer man wastes away, but the inner man is renewed day by day, we go, oh, as we get older, our eyesight gets worse, and yeah, we know exactly what Paul was going through. Paul's writing about being persecuted. Like, I don't think he's talking about just generally getting older. Like, he's getting beat with rods all the time, and he's in shipwrecks and stuff. That's what he's talking about, I think. Although, it is still true that as we get older, you know. Alright. Well, yeah, Ronnie?
I was wondering when you get older, and you maybe can't do what you used to do, and it can be more physical, you know,
mentally even?
Well, spiritually.
Memory?
Certainly, and everything. I'm wondering, you know, we can feel guilty about that, and maybe the proper response would be accept it and do the things that we love, the things we talked about, that we still can do, and not let that pull us down, so to speak. You know, well, I still should never do it, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I mean, like, for me, like, there's... Because of my lack of wisdom, there's certain situations that I don't know how to deal with, and I need other people to help me with. Do you see how the older and the younger people, like, complement each other here? And sometimes in churches, you can have, like, the younger people that don't have respect for the wisdom of the older people, and then the older people could look down at the younger people for not having much wisdom when they actually, like, have things that need to be complemented with each other. Is it like when there's some churches that have, like, youth ministers, or churches that have, like, contemporary services that are supposed to attract the younger people? Like, why are you trying to divide up the ages? Like, we all need each other. And we need everybody, no matter what age you are, needs the humility to recognize that we do need each other. So, yeah.
I will say that between 25 and 50, I wish I had made different choices and listened to older people more than I did. Because now from 50 to 80, I see them different where I should have made some better choices like that.
Anything else?
All right, let's get to Numbers 9 then, and look at God's guidance. So in chapter 9, verses 1 through 14, you've got the first Passover. So it's been a year since they were delivered. And so now they're going to commemorate the first one in the wilderness. Again, verses 3 through 5, they do it exactly like what they were supposed to do. But there's this situation that comes up that brings an exception. And I want to read verses 6 through 14. So let's go ahead and read Numbers 9, verses 6 through 14. And there were certain men who were unclean through the touching of a dead body, so that they could not keep the Passover on that day. And they came before Moses and Aaron on that day. And those men said to him, "We are unclean through touching a dead body. Why are we kept from bringing the Lord's offering at its appointed time among the people of Israel?" And Moses said to them, "Wait that I may hear what the Lord will command concerning you." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if one of you or of any of your descendants is unclean through touching a dead body, or is on a long journey, he shall still keep the Passover to the Lord. In the second month, on the 14th day at twilight, they shall keep it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break any of its bones, according to all the statute for the Passover, that they shall keep it. But if anyone who is clean and is not on a journey fails to keep the Passover, that person shall be cut off from his people because he did not bring the Lord's offering at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin. And if a stranger sojourns among you and would keep the Passover to the Lord according to the statute of the Passover and according to its rule, so shall he do. You shall have one statute both for the sojourner and for the native." Okay. So in this situation, you've got a couple people that are unclean because they touched a dead body. Maybe a loved one passed away or whatever, and they had to bury the person. And so whatever the circumstances were, what is it that they still want to do? They still want to take the Passover. I think there's lessons in that. Have you ever had a time before where you were like really sick and you couldn't come to church? And like the way that you actually thought about it deep down was like, well, it's legitimate that I shouldn't be there, but it's kind of convenient because I just didn't want to go today. You know, I never had thoughts like that. Like, it's kind of nice to have a little bit of rest right now anyways and stuff. For these people, they like touched a dead body and they weren't thinking, well, it's really like, I don't like crowds, and it's just kind of like, we already did the Passover like a year ago, the actual event happened, like if we do it every year, it's going to lose its meaning, right? So like, let's just not do it every year. They didn't come up with any kind of like crazy excuses like this. They actually wanted to go ahead and do it. And so their question is, do we have to wait till next year? Now, do you guys have any comments or questions just up to verse 7? So Moses just kind of shoots from the hip, and because he's supposed to be the Bible answer man, says, "I got your answer, right?" What does he do in verse 8? Yeah, let me talk to the Lord about this, and he's going to help us know how to deal with this situation. You guys are obviously very sincere and genuine. You can't partake of it, and it's really not because you've done any kind of sin or anything like that. And so God comes back to him, and what does he say? Yeah, they can do it a month later. And so there's this special provision that people who are traveling or people that are unclean can take it 1 month later, and they have to do it exactly like the Bible says and everything like that. And I think one lesson to learn from this, does God understand it when you can't legitimately be somewhere? Yes. Like, okay, so Samantha, Abigail was born on Father's Day on a Sunday at 4:44 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon. And then I got a text from the guy that he was a former preacher, and he's one of the members there. He said, "Just wondering, are you going to happen to be here tonight?" I said, "No." And that was pretty legitimate, I think. And here's maybe another point of application from this. Could God understand, is it within God's character to understand that if somebody legitimately couldn't be there Sunday morning, would there be a parallel to the Lord's Supper being offered Sunday night? Now, this is a divisive issue. There's a lot of people that have had a lot of disagreements and arguments over this, and I know that this is not talking about the Lord's Supper. But I will say that it seems to be within God's character to understand when there was a legitimate reason you couldn't be somewhere. Now, he's careful in this. He says, but if there was somebody that was clean and there's somebody that wasn't traveling, they can't use this second Passover as an excuse for more convenience. Do some people sometimes do that with Sunday evening Lord's Supper. Sometimes that might be the case, where they wanted to sleep in or whatever, and well, I can take it Sunday night, whatever. That's not who that's for. This second offering of the Passover was for people that had legitimate reasons they couldn't be there. Does this speak directly to the Lord's Supper? No, it doesn't. Does it say something about God's character? Maybe it does. Yeah.
Oh, well, I understand that the matter of offering the Lord's Supper on Sunday night started during the Second World War, when there were so many that worked long shifts building defense type things.
Okay.
And they could not be there on Sunday morning. And so, you know, to many of the Christians, that seemed a legitimate reason.
Right.
But still, I know people have to go with their conscience.
Well, and it's interesting to hear that God, like, kind of acknowledges, hey, look, like, we're going to allow the second Passover. There's going to be some knuckleheads that are going to try to misuse this. And those people, like, they shouldn't feel good about what they're doing.
You know, just take a trip and say, well, I don't even have to plan. We'll get there by Sunday night. Well, sometimes you can't help it, but, you know, you better pay attention to what you know God said and deal with your own conscience in the right way.
Right. And now, some people would say, by opposite of what I'm kind of alluding to here, is that, well, Moses had to ask God directly, and God gave Moses an answer. We don't have a direct answer in the New Testament about a second offering of the Lord's Supper. To which, and then that's why what I keep saying is, like, for me, like, the minimal thing I can say about this is that this is saying something about God's character. And I feel like that's instructive. Sherry?
I was going a different direction with it. Essentially, they said, we want to serve God. We can't do it because we're unclean. Moses didn't say, oh, I'm so sorry. You have every right to serve God. And
right.
But instead he says, let me see what God is saying. And I couldn't help thinking about women who think they have talents that need to be used publicly in God's service.
Yeah.
And people say, well, you're right. You have a talent. You have the desire. You have the will. And we ought to let you. But when you go to see what God has to say about it, he says no.
Right.
And we have to accept that. Because that's the way he set it up. Sometimes he may give an exception, sometimes he may not, but we don't have the right to make the exception.
That's right.
Unless we check with God and see that he has allowed the exception.
Yes. Yeah, well, we see with Moses, like, they didn't have all of the Bible revealed. Like, these conversations Moses had with God is the Bible, yes, up to this point. And so we've got stuff to draw back on that Moses didn't even have.
And if somebody came and said, why can't I do that? I would say, let's see what the Word of God has to say. What has God revealed to us?
Right, exactly.
And
very good.
No exception.
When Jacob was talking about when they started the Lord's Supper at night, back when I was a teenager, if an older person could not come to the service, there would be a group of people who go out to their house and sing and read scriptures and all that and serve it. But now these days, they seem to think it's a sin to do it.
When I was preaching in Rochester, the little church there when I was in college, I did that on occasion for some people. The question then becomes, if it's only for one person, you know, like, and this gets into all kinds of things that I really don't want to talk about right now. So anything else that you just want to say about these? You guys are free to disagree with me. You probably can see where I stand on that issue. But I think we can have differences of opinion on it and still love each other because that's what we're told to do, you know. All right, let's talk then about God's guidance in the wilderness. Were you going to say something, Sam?
I was going to ask you what your opinion of it was.
Oh, I think it's okay to have an offering of the Lord's Supper on Sunday nights. I don't think that I can find anything inherently wrong with it. Are there misuses and abuses of it? Yeah. Can I see an explicit example in the New Testament of them doing it? No. But are there people that are gathering together that are still doing it, like, in the way that we do it here and all that kind of stuff? Does God's character seem to understand legitimate reasons people couldn't be there? And part of the reason that I have maybe a stronger opinion about it is when I left the church in Rochester to go train with Gary Kircheville, so I got my degree, I left the church there, and right when I was leaving, there was a couple families that moved in from Florida and some other places. And there was some people from another church in Minnesota that would come and preach for them every week. And when I was there with one other guy, and then the rest was a family of old women. So Russ and I were there, and we offered the Lord's Supper Sunday morning and Sunday night. We were also concerned about the excuses people made, it was more convenient to just be there Sunday night. So we talked about all this kind of stuff.
But we still like allowed people to have, do a Sunday night if it was legitimate and all that kind of stuff. So we left, and then some of the members started calling me saying, hey, these people that are coming from these other churches to preach for us, they're demanding that we stop doing the Sunday night, and it's made some of these new people that just moved in leave. And now they're going to the institutional church down the street and stuff. I'm like, there's just unnecessary things that I think that you're making too much of a deal out of some of that stuff that you shouldn't be fighting over. For things like that to divide a church, I think is just crazy. I'm not saying it's wrong to have an opinion about it. I'm not saying it's wrong to have a strong opinion about it. But at least have some love in the way that you're trying to deal with all of this stuff. So I'm probably going to get myself in trouble now. So I'll stop talking about it.
I'm 90 years old and I'm calling you to bring me love stuff you come.
We'll talk about that.
Years old.
When the limitations of age come upon me. Alright, I want to read verses 15 through 23, and I just want you to notice how repetitious this passage is, and try to ask yourself, why is God could have said all of what he's going to say in verses 15 through 23. He could have said it in one verse, but he extends it out to like 7 or 8 verses. Look at verses 15 through 23. On the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle and the tent of the testimony, and at evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night, and whenever the cloud lifted from over the tent, after that the people of Israel set out in the place where the cloud settled down. There are the people of Israel encamped. At the command of the Lord, the people of Israel set out, and at the command of the Lord they camped. As long as the cloud rested over the tabernacle, they remained in the camp. Even when the cloud continued over the tabernacle many days, the people of Israel kept charge of the Lord and did not set out. Sometimes the cloud was a few days over the tabernacle. According to the command of the Lord, they remained in the camp. Then according to the command of the Lord, they set out. And sometimes the cloud remained from evening until morning, and when the cloud lifted in the morning, they set out. Or if it continued for a day and a night, when the cloud lifted, they set out. Whether it was 2 days or a month or a longer time that the cloud remained over the tabernacle, abiding there, the people of Israel remained in the camp and did not set out, but when it lifted, they set out. At the command of the Lord, they camped. At the command of the Lord, they set out. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by Moses. All right. What's the point of all that? Yeah, like, so when did they move? Did everybody catch when they would move? Yeah, and this was all by the command of the Lord. They got this fire and this cloud. All they have to do is look. Oh, is it moving? Okay, we should move too. Is it not moving? Like, every day they'd get up, like, where is it right now? And so they would follow that, and it was a living symbol for them to know when they should leave and when they shouldn't. We have, in Jesus we've got something better than that, because we've got his direction and his guidance and stuff like that. But what do you think a lesson from this could be?
Be ready.
Yeah, okay, good. So, like, be ready to set out when God says that it's time to move. What else? Yeah. Like, everything's got to be by his command. Were you secure?
Sometimes, I'm sure that especially when it came in and settled for a night, and they unpacked, and they set up the tent, and the next morning, there goes that cloud again.
Right.
Must have been, times like that, and other times when things seemed to be, the cloud stayed for a month or a year, it would have been really easy to get settled.
Yes.
And get stuck. And then it was really inconvenient when you had to pack up the thing. God has his timing, and we have to adapt to his timing instead of what seems convenient or inconvenient or
right.
Whatever.
Good. Were you going to say something?
They learned all that at the Red Sea.
Yeah, they saw this initially at the Red Sea, and then it continues with them. Were you going to say something, Aaron?
Oh, I was just going to say, in God's time.
Yeah.
She continued, that's what she said.
Yeah, do you guys think that God has more involvement or less involvement in our lives today? I'm not saying that we can know, what he's doing, we're not going to, get signs and hints and feelings and tugs from the Holy Spirit that's going to, tell us where to go and what to do and all this kind of stuff. But is there a sense in which you could say, I was in California for a few years, and for some of the time I was there, I was going, why am I here? I don't know why I'm here right now.
And then, like, in time, it started to become more apparent after things. Like, in the past, you could look at it and go, okay, this made a lot of sense. Like, I could move here and go, why am I here? Like, what's going on? And then I might not know the answers right now, but, like, after the course of some years or whatever, I could go, okay, this makes sense now.
That's what I was just trying to say. Between 25 and 50, you make different choices. Later on, you see that you didn't do it right. So when you're out in California, you probably know why you're out there, but God's still working the same way. Is he working right now?
Right.
You know
him. I was talking to a preacher on the phone Monday. He preaches in San Jose, California. It was one of the churches that we almost moved to, actually, before we went to San Diego. And he was talking to me, and he said, you should be really happy that you didn't come here. Because the elders just asked him to leave for some reasons. I mean, he's telling me his side of the story and all that kind of stuff. But, like, the thing I just said to him is, I said, I guess the cloud's moving up, isn't it? You know, like... If you trust that God has got some control over your life, and I don't know how it works and all that kind of thing, should that give you some degree of comfort when you start to feel uncomfortable about where you are?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like any decision we make, we do like Moses, and we ask God. He doesn't tell me directly, but I feel like if I'm saying, is, you know, should I go here to preach? I mean, am I to preach, you know? When you're trying to decide what you're going to do and you're asking for God's guidance, I think what decision you make has to God directed.
Right. Can you make a decision on where you're going to go and what you're going to do? Like, that's just straight up self-centered, the wrong way. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure that that's God's guidance. But if you're like, if you're trying to seek good counsel, you're praying about it, all that kind of stuff, like, could you more confidently say, like, I feel like I was kind of like, this is where I'm supposed to be right now, and I might not know why. The Israelites might not have known why they were... I think it is it Numbers 33 where it shows all the places that they encamped. That this chapter kind of links to that. But if I really believe that God was more orchestrating my life than maybe I've sometimes believed, I think it would give me a lot more peace of mind.
I think sometimes it gives us opportunities, and we have to be, as somebody said, be ready, because that opportunity may come when it seems very inconvenient, and yet we can see that it's a good thing that needs to be done.
Right.
And
like your dad going to, you know, Africa, New York, and all these different areas. Yeah, good.
You know, there's a song that says, he may not come when you want him, but he always on time.
Yeah. Right. I don't know that song. Is that a hymn?
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's true. I mean, we might ask God for something. He might not give it to us right then.
Yeah.
He don't give it to us when we feel like it's ready for
us. Sure.
When we're ready for it.
That passage you just read, I noticed in this verse, it wasn't New American Standard, that the word command each time it says literally mouth. And I don't know if that would imply anything.
His commands come from his metaphorical mouth? I'm not sure. I don't know. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
No.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's New American Standard, and I'm looking at it.
Okay.
Yeah.
In 789, God is speaking to Moses. Maybe that was part of how all of this worked too, whenever they would move. All right, well, we're a little bit over time, and we covered like a lot of stuff. So I think next week, so when the gospel meeting's here, we're not going to do this, because isn't Andy doing a Tuesday morning thing anyways and stuff, so yeah. So we'll just not do it on, would that be the 24th or something? But next week, Lord willing, we'll do chapters 10 and 11 and maybe 12. Let's tentatively plan for 10 through 12. So, Ronnie, is that okay if I ask you to pray for us?
Dear Father in heaven, I'm so thankful to you. And the way you bless us, we're thankful for your care and for your love for us. And we think about who we are, and we do not feel deserving for many things for all the things that we receive and blessings from you, the spiritual blessings, our salvation. We're thankful for your mercy and your grace, your patience with us, and for our forgiveness. We pray that you'd be with us today and help us to live in a way that you'd be pleased with us, and that we might be lights to others, and that when we do deeds that should reflect back to you, do those with a sincere heart. And we ask you to forgive us of our sins in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Yeah.